I personally think it's important that leaders get comfortable with owning revenue. I don't know what's going to happen in 2024. I wish I did, but my gut says we're going to have a little bit more tough times before it gets better. And when, you know, as somebody who has owned finance, right, in an organization, I know when I'm doing an audit on line by line expenses, I'm looking to cut things that are non-mission critical, things that are not driving direct revenue, things that are not protecting future revenue. And you have to be very clear about how you tie those things together. So that's a good thing for folks to keep in mind, because it's a reality that's happening not just within their internal organizations, but at their customer organizations as well.
Welcome to the Super Managers Podcast, where we interview leaders from all walks of life to tease out the habits, thought patterns, learnings, and experiences that help them be extraordinary at the fine craft of management. Our goal is to bring you the lessons and the insights so that you don't have to learn through your own mistakes, but so that you can shortcut your way to being a great leader. This podcast is brought to you by Fellow, a software platform that helps managers and their teams collaborate on meeting agendas, track action items, and turn chaotic meetings into productive work sessions. Check it out at www.fellow.app. Hey, fellow managers and leaders, I'm Aiden, and I'm the CEO of Fellow.app. Today, I'm very excited to introduce you to Miranda Dekonski. She's had an extensive leadership career, including at companies like Swiftly, Catalyst. Today, she's Senior Vice President of Customer Success at DataAssembly. And today, we talk about a variety of different topics, including onboarding new members onto your team, how to bring them on board, get them set up, and get them to their aha moments, and get them to be productive within your teams as fast as possible. We talk about all the lessons that Miranda has learned in actually interviewing people, including a test that she does that I think is one of the most clever tests that I've heard about in the onboarding process and the interview process itself. And we talk about how to build high performance teams and lessons learned there, including talking about one-on-ones, how Miranda runs them. And finally, how in these times, every single team really needs to focus on this idea of being tied back to revenue, because at the end of the day, that is a core component of how companies run. So before we dive in, just wanted to say thank you for everyone who has been giving us reviews on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts. Thank you so much. We really appreciate it. If you haven't done that yet, it takes 2 seconds. Give us a review. We really, really appreciate it. It helps us promote the show and get the guests that we do. And of course, if you want to join our community, very easy to do. If you send us an email to supermanagers@fellow.app, we will be sure to let you in and you can hear about what's going on in the community, get management advice, do a lot of networking, all around great time. And with that said, and without further ado, here's Miranda Dekonski on this episode of the Super Managers Podcast. Miranda, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thank you for having me. Excited to have this conversation.
Yeah, super excited to do this as well. I know that you've spent a leadership career at a variety of different companies, Swiftly, Catalyst. Today, you're Senior Vice President at DataAssembly. So wanted to maybe start from the beginning, though. Do you remember when you first started to manage or lead a team? What were some of the early mistakes that you used to make?
Oh my gosh, I made so many mistakes. So if we go way, way back, when I was 17, I was doing management type work at a restaurant. And that was, you know, my first foray into management. But that is a very different type of management than when you're in tech. So early on, though, in tech, when I first started managing, some of the mistakes I made were, I mean, micromanaging, quite frankly. You know, I didn't grasp the concept of just hire smart folks and get out of their way. I wanted to know every little detail, every little bit in the minutia of what was going on. How was it being done? Were the I's dotted and the T's crossed? I'm a very operational person and think about, you know, process and optimization and quality and stuff like that, like as a hobby. So, you know, when you first make that jump into people management and that's your natural state, that tends to be how you manage. And I had a lot to learn, and it took a while to get over that and figure out how to just get better. Better for myself and better for the people around me, quite frankly.
Yeah. And do you remember how you realized that you need to make a change?
Honestly, when I knew, you know, I take things very seriously and personally, and I knew I was impacting people negatively with my management style. Like, maybe there was a certain fear of me, and I didn't like that. It's not how I wanted to be. That's not how I wanted to manage. And I also knew it wasn't going to serve me well for longevity in my career. And this is, we're talking 15 years ago, right? And yeah, I think it was one of those moments where I'm very self-reflective and just sitting down and taking a look at where I was and where I wanted to be. Very raw and scary to share this on a podcast, but hey, if it helps others, then that's great.
Yeah. And that's, you know, certainly the intention. It's the first question we start with every time and we get right into it. So yeah, thank you for sharing that. And it is really important to just see how you came upon these realizations. And so my question is, how did you turn it around? Was it just a switch? You said,
no,
I'm going to do it differently. And then the next day, everything was great. Or what was the process like? What did you have to start doing differently?
Well, first, I had to put in some basic frameworks to solve for whatever it was in my brain that I needed to solve for to allow it to take a step back. So, you know, setting up things like KPIs, goals, OKRs, check-in points to where I had a pulse on what was going on in the organization. I had a coach, an executive coach that I worked with to create toolkits to figure out how to be able to adjust my style depending on who I was managing or who I was working with, right? It was many years of working on myself. And, you know, I think also, I hate to say this, but just age helps. You know, this was in my early 30s. I'm now in my mid 40s, right? We are all very different people as we grow. I would imagine you're not the same person now as you were at 20 or 25 or, you know, I'm not going to assume how old you are, so I'll stop at 25. And you know,
I'm a little younger than that, but no, I'm just kidding.
But, you know, it also just growth and evolution and being self-aware and continuously investing in yourself. It's not a switch, though. It's acknowledging that different people need different things from you. And your management style can't be a one-size-fits-all approach. And if it is, you're bound to either leave some heartache in your wake or not be effective or impactful in a way that you could be if you could figure out how to navigate what's needed by different people.
Yeah, I think this is all true. And the, you know, the comment about age is an interesting one because it is hard because like the older you get, the more life experiences you get, you know, as you yourself have a family, as you yourself have various life experiences that are both, you know, at times happy, at other times painful, it helps you kind of appreciate things that other people go through as well. And again, when you're young and you're getting into this stuff, you haven't experienced it. And so you try to empathize, you try to understand these things, but you're kind of approaching it from an academic sense. And then there's the, okay, now I've experienced this stuff. I know what it means and you know, how I need to tread differently in different circumstances. So yeah, definitely point taken there too.
Yeah, earlier this year, I led a company COO function through two rounds of layoffs. And it's been a rough year for tech. And you see lots of CEOs getting blasted on social media about how they handled it well or didn't handle it well. And I probably was one of those that were poo-pooing how folks were handling it. Don't get me wrong. Some of the ways that people handled it were just poor. Right? You just shut somebody's email off and be like, surprise, today's your last day. Like, that's bad. But myself having sit on 30 back-to-back Zoom calls, looking at people in the eyes and telling them that today is their last day and talking them through their packages, I have a very different level of empathy than I did prior. It's always easy to be like that armchair warrior and speculate. But until you live through those types of things, you just don't really get it, you know?
Yeah. And there's some niceness into the naivety that comes with being early on in the process. And yeah, some obviously good things that come from experience too. So Yeah, thank you for sharing that. And, you know, I know that you spent a lot of time in operations, like you're very operational leader, focusing a lot on customer success as a function. One of the things that you've focused on is just building really great customer success operations and thinking about onboarding and how to very effectively onboard new people that are coming onto the team. And I was wondering if we could spend some time, you know, diving into some of your learnings. You know, what have you learned about, you know, building customer success, onboarding, and what are some lessons learned and how has the approach evolved over the course of time?
Yeah, so I'm going to bucket two things together here. I'm going to bucket customer onboarding and team member onboarding together. I know that may sound a little crazy, but follow me here. I also have owned human resources for multiple years. And if you think about the life cycle and journey of a customer and the life cycle and journey of a team member, the correlation is quite uncanny, right? And what is the most important part of the life cycle of a customer? It's generally like getting them to time to first value quickly, right? And making sure that they get the problems you're solving, that you're able to provide them a seamless service, a seamless experience, and they want to use your product all the time, right? The same thing with a team member. If you think about it, you have a new team member, you've gone through so much to get them in the door. And now it's time to get them to their time to first value quickly. And I'm playing it this way just to help CS leaders understand and see that correlation. So when you're building out that onboarding plan, you want to think, what is that? What does that look like? And time to first value for a new team member is generally, you know, having quick wins and getting that dopamine hit. Like, this is where I belong and I get it and I want to be here and I want to be impactful. So when I orchestrate an onboarding process, I'm thinking about what are the basic foundational components that they need to know about the company? What are the things they need to know about the role? What are things they need to know about the systems that they're going to use? And how are these not just like you log in here, but what are the whys behind these are the tools, right? If the tools are maybe less obvious tools, like feeding them that why so they can figure out what's in it for me. How does this make my life easier? And then figuring out ongoing engagement, ongoing dopamine hits, ongoing wins. And that's how you keep the employees, you keep your team members in the same way you keep your customers, right? It all, like if you map it out side by side, it's oddly very well correlated. And that's how I tend to approach onboarding.
It's super interesting. We do all these things for our customers and like we've kind of refined the process and we figured out all the best practices around it. But you're right, like a lot of this stuff translates very directly to how you handle your teams or how you can onboard, you know, people onto your team. Do you have an example of something that maybe is really different or unique about the way that you've onboarded people onto your team in the past?
I mean, I don't know if it's different or unique. I'm sure other companies do it. One, you make sure they have a mentor internally, somebody that, especially in remote environments, somebody that they can just hop on and be on Zoom with, their first friend. You know, there are studies out there that say folks that have best friends at work tend to stay longer. So you want to try to help facilitate that. They have a plan in their hand when they start. So what are you going to be doing for the first week or two? This is especially important in remote environments where it can be lonely, right? So imagine being a new person, you know nobody in the company, and you're trying to figure out how to navigate. It makes it less scary if you have a roadmap that tells you, today you're going to be learning this. These are the milestones you're going to achieve. These are the people you're going to get to know. And these are the functions that they own, right? And you map it all out for the first few weeks before you set them loose to do their role and move from their onboarding into their OKRs, right? Again, I don't know if it's unique, but those are a few things that I do to make sure that new hires are set up for success and they're not, you know, sitting out there by themselves floundering.
So the designated first friend sounds like a super interesting concept. So how do you get volunteers to do that? And is it like very official? Like this is your onboarding buddy, they'll stick with you for the first month or something like that?
Generally, yes. Generally, it's very official. You'll ask. I do prefer if it's somebody that's not within the team, the same team.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. Sometimes that's a little bit harder to get. But hey, we have so-and-so that's starting. I would love for them to have an onboarding buddy. You'll check in with them once a day and see how they're doing. And, you know, you're not responsible for their onboarding. You're just kind of there just to, you know, have someone to chit chat with. Imagine like if you were in the office and you're at the water cooler. I don't know if companies even have water coolers anymore, like offices, but imagine you're in the kitchen and you're making your avocado toast. Who else is in the kitchen making their avocado toast, right? And you start seeing that friendly face. That's the whole purpose of it. It's not to go into the technical nuances of the product or, you know, go over role specific stuff. I find it though to be more impactful if it's somebody not in their team. They're going to see people in their team all the time. Like, let's get them that buddy that's not in the team.
Yeah, that's super interesting. And how do you encourage this as part of the culture? So for example, you know, do you volunteer people to become a buddy for somebody else, or, you know, people just volunteer to do it themselves?
Generally, people volunteer, especially if they've been through the process, they know the value in it and they want to give back. I've never had a problem historically getting volunteers for somebody to be a buddy. The only time it is a problem is when you're hiring crazy pants and everybody's burned out. Then you might have to tap on internal team members to say, hey, would you be their buddy? But generally, I've not had issues with that.
Yeah, I love it. And so when you think about the actual process of onboarding, especially because you have owned also human resources functions too. So what's typically involved? Is it actually like a 3-week process? So they're learning things for that amount of time before they do anything else?
Sometimes longer. It depends on the product. It depends on the role. It depends on the milestone. So for example, at one company, I had a team that was responsible for APIs. And, you know, they were quasi engineers and they would embed APIs into our customers' websites. And they would have to learn one extra step beyond where like the customer success managers, right? Because they would need to learn about like how our APIs work, the API documentation, and how do you make a pull request and a push request. And they would need to learn all of that stuff. So their onboarding would be even longer. The answer is, and if folks are trying to figure out how long their onboarding should be, it should be however long it takes to get the person to where they're comfortable to be successful. And that could vary by person as well, not just function. Now, I would say you should have a barometer, or you should have like kind of an idea on average how long it takes. So if on average it takes somebody 3 weeks and you have somebody that's maybe 6 weeks out, that you might have a problem with fit depending on where they're getting hung up on their milestones program. If you have someone that took 2 weeks, you might want to just double click and make sure they really understand the fundamentals, right? So understand where your average is and how much time you think it should take, and then pay attention to those data points.
You know, one of the things that, you know, anybody who starts in customer success obviously really needs to understand the product, but so do a lot of other teams, whether they're in sales, it's really useful for product people to understand it. You know, arguably everybody in the company should really understand the product. Are there any things that you've seen or ways of structuring product training that you've seen that has really worked well? Like, who takes responsibility for it? Given that it's something that, again, in theory, every person in the company could kind of benefit from. Yeah, just like any best practices or really effective ways to get everybody in the company really well trained on the product?
Yeah, at Swiftly, we spun up something called the Swiftly University, and we had 3 different levels. It was Swiftly 101, Swiftly, you know, 201, whatever, right? And we would stagger it throughout the first couple of weeks of their training. And, you know, initially it would be, we would hire a person, and it would be a person with somebody else taking them through this pre-created deck. You would create the deck and all the content that need to be covered in the deck, and to make the teacher's job easy. And then it became, you know, we would hold it once a month for each of them. And anyone that started within that month had to attend these sessions. And there was always a volunteer in the organization that would teach it. It was created in a way that it would be easy for anyone to teach. Didn't matter your role, except when you get to that 300 level, then we would need somebody from product or who is like a solutions engineer type mind who could go into a little bit more of the technical nuances. But, you know, we would always ask for volunteers for the next couple of months, have the professors assigned. I won't lie, it worked well. It got us what we needed. When people get busy, they stop raising their hand. So we had to continuously think about it, iterate. And sometimes it did feel like we were begging for volunteers. But we felt so passionate about the program itself that we kept it and kept on it. And I do believe it still exists today.
That's awesome. And so there's 101, 201, 301 type classes, and these kind of recur every single month, right? What was that the idea? So if you just started as a new employee, over the next 3 months, you would have exposure to these. And it was required for them to attend, right? It was not like a voluntary thing?
It was required. And it wasn't that you would get 1 month. It was all in 1 month.
Oh, it was all in 1 month.
And if you needed a refresher as an employee, let's say you were 3 months in and you're like, you know what, maybe I don't understand this as much as possible. You know that this class is going to be taught again and you can go and get the foundation retaught to you.
Yeah, I really like that because there's all these side benefits too, right? So especially if different people are teaching the class, A, it's an opportunity for you to meet other people, for the new people to interact with someone else. It's an opportunity for people to practice their public speaking.
Exactly.
Like there's a lot of really great benefit that comes from that. Yeah, that's a really cool approach. Thank you for explaining that.
Yeah.
The other thing I wanted to also talk to you about is just interviews in general. So I know you have a customer success interview blueprint. You've done this a bunch of times. I'm sure that your blueprint has evolved from like when it was first originally ideated. Would love for you to explain like how it works and what are the things that have changed over the course of time?
Well, one, we don't do the on-site anymore. So that's a big change. If you recall, I don't know which version of my blueprint you saw, but you know, part of it was you have them back again for another round where they do their presentation. We've completely adapted all of this to be done virtually. And we still do 2 rounds. So that's the biggest change. 2, I don't actively share this out with candidates. You know, I had in the past, but I leave it out there as an Easter egg for them to find. If a candidate finds it, they completely know what to expect. And that's like an extra bonus point for me if somebody's like, has found this blueprint, because part of customer success is sometimes you have to be an investigator, like a natural investigator. You have to be curious and out there like digging and trying to figure out who it is you're going to talk to, right? I mean, we have to get on calls all the time with people we don't know and have difficult conversations. So that's part of it. The overall blueprint, though, how I thought about it when I was designing it was thinking about the skill sets that are needed for the organization I'm in right now. It is meant not to be a plug and play solution for other CS leaders, but more of like a guideline on what you could do and adapt it to make it your own. I really like a few of the activities that I really like in it that I continue to use to this day. One, I like the prioritization method in there. So as part of the phone screen, I will give a potential CSM 5 things that they could potentially encounter on their plate and ask them to prioritize it. And it can be anything, you know, and I shift them around a little bit. But the example I gave was you have a newly signed customer that needs to be onboarded. You have an enterprise level customer that's having a major technical issue that's hurting their ability to use your product. You have an EBR that you need to give in the next 7 days. You have OKRs that need to be updated for a meeting that's happening the next day. And then you have 10 unread Zendesk tickets. Where do you start, right? For me, it's not as much about the answers. It's more about how they critically think and the questions that they ask to show me how they advocate for themselves. So for example, I specifically say you have an EBR. And then if they put the EBR last, you know, because they have 7 days, I ask them, what will you include in your EBR? And I find more people have no idea what an EBR is. They just put it last because they have 7 days and they didn't ask me, what is an EBR, right? And it's not supposed to be like a trick question. It's more of, hey, you're going to be working remote on an island by yourself. Are you going to advocate for yourself? Are you going to ask questions to get to the root of what it is you need to do? Or are you just going to make assumptions, right? So that's really a lot of the activities I do in my, you know, playbook. It's less about what's right or wrong, and it's more about me seeing how you critically think, how you advocate, how you investigate, how you show up.
Hey, before we move on to the rest of the episode, if you're an engineering leader, whether manager, director, or VP, all engineering leaders know that one-on-one meetings are a powerful tool for team engagement and productivity. However, not all leaders know how to run these meetings effectively. That's why the Fellow team just released a comprehensive guide on the art of the one-on-one meeting for engineers. It has over 60 pages of advice from engineering leaders at organizations like Apple, MailChimp, Stripe, GitHub, Intel, and more. We've also included expert-approved templates for you to apply immediately to make your one-on-one meetings that much more effective. So head on over to fellow.app/resources to access the guide and the exclusive templates right now. We'll also link it in the show notes for you to check out there, but you can go on over to fellow.app/resources to get the guide and the templates today. And with that said, let's go back to the interview. You know, the idea of just giving people a list of things to prioritize, I think is so smart. And the reason I say this is because it's so hard to figure out if someone is good at prioritizing. And prioritizing is, it's one of those things where everybody might say like, yeah, I'm better than average at prioritizing. But like, how do you actually test that? This is the first time I've heard of, you know, someone actually giving a test with real life examples and putting it in front of them. And I think that's super smart. And I think it applies to many, many other roles. But especially in the customer context, I am curious from all the ones that you mentioned, if you were asked that question, which would you prioritize first?
Well, first and foremost, I'm going to look at the enterprise level customer that's having a major technical issue. If they can't use the product at all, that's like, that's a problem. And then I'm going to do a quick skim in those 10 unread Zendesk tickets just to see, is this an isolated issue with this customer or are we getting Zendesk tickets, right? And usually customer success doesn't touch Zendesk tickets, but you know, I put this in here as an example. Let's assume you have emails, right? I'm going to quickly skim to see, is this a big issue or is this just an issue impacting this customer? The next thing I'm going to do after that is I'm going to send out whatever I need to on the newly signed customer and figure out what needs to do to get the onboarding kicked off, right? Get the meeting scheduled, send over the welcome packet or whatever it may be, and a nice welcome email telling them what to expect, along with probably my Calendly link to get time on to start onboarding. Then I am going to move to my executive business review, take a quick skim to see, are there any details that I need from other teams? Like, are there anything that I need that's going to be able to make this the best executive business review possible that is dependent on others? If so, I need to get those requests out now so I know that I am successful, because I am a big believer. You've got to have that executive business review presentation done like 5 days before the business review, not like the day before or the day of. So you and the team you're collaborating with can iterate and really make sure the narrative is seamless. And then lastly, the OKR is getting those updated, you know, and making sure the latest and greatest on where you are with the key results and activities you own are moving in the right direction. It's an ongoing thing though with OKRs. That should be something that's incorporated into your everyday. So I would anticipate if you were being diligent in your role, it wouldn't be a big deal. You would just need to go in and say, check, check, checkity check. Yes, I've done this. No, this has been deprioritized and that should not take you very long at all. That's how I would do it.
Yeah, I love it. And, you know, as you're explaining this, I almost feel like it would make really good onboarding content too. Just almost like, you know, prioritization mini class or something like that. And just, I mean, it's a great interview question, but I feel like it's also useful for people to understand the mindset of some of these things. Because I feel like some of this prioritization, you know, maybe you pick up some of these things once you've had a few years of experience, but then, you know, if you are just starting out, it probably helps to learn some of this stuff, even if it is in the form of a class.
Absolutely. And you gave me an idea. Maybe I'll do that.
Yeah, it could be interesting. So, okay, so we've talked about onboarding. We've talked a little bit about hiring. Now let's talk about the team. So, you know, you've built a lot of customer success teams. What makes a super successful team, a high performing one?
The higher performing customer success teams that I see, they act like they're the business owners of their portfolio. They know the business, they know the ins and outs of their customers, they understand what, you know, value looks like to them. They have goals documented. They're working in partnership with their customers to solve those goals. It drives them crazy if something's not updated in our systems, right? So they're on top of stuff. Really, you know, the only way I could describe it, like I said, when I started, is they act like entrepreneurs. Like, this is their business. They take it very seriously and they run it like a business.
And so what are the team aspects of that, though? Like, does each person own a portfolio? Is it a group of people that own a portfolio together?
Generally, I work in small to mid-sized startups that have larger contracts. So each CSM will own a portfolio. They'll own a set of accounts, and that's their responsibility to make sure that those customers are achieving value and growing. Now, I will say I'm a big proponent of team and the value of team, but I'm a believer that if multiple people own something, nobody really owns it. So that's why we have account assignments. Now, to help with like the team mentality, I do structure goals in a way that helps drive team level participation in accounts. So for example, my CSMs are generally bonused on two things: gross renewal. So your gross dollar renewal, I have $100 up for renewal, how much renewed this month, right? The second thing is a more of a team goal, and that's your net retention. So not only how much did I renew, but how much did I expand? So we are always navigating resource constraints in every organization. So the reason why I believe in net retention as a team number is because we all have to make decisions about who gets prioritized and what gets prioritized. And sometimes your account won't get prioritized, but if another account is winning and we're still growing, you know, in a way that everybody wins, that's good. So that's how I tend to split it.
Got it. And so one of the things that I know is, you know, top of mind these days is just this idea of, you know, what's going on in the economy. Obviously, all of us are being asked to operate on a more lean basis and do more with less and, you know, be responsible. Everybody kind of being responsible for revenue a little bit. And one of the things that, you know, I've often come across is that for a lot of CSM professionals, it's possible that that's not their default place to go, right? To also be responsible for revenue or expansion. Like, they might be uncomfortable with those sorts of concepts. And some companies divide it out, right? They say like, well, we have CSMs and that's different than, say, an account manager that is maybe responsible for expansion. Like, how do you think about this stuff? Should the customer success team own that? I mean, again, it is, you mentioned it's a team goal of a net revenue retention, but how should they think about revenue in general?
Yeah, so first of all, there are no one-size-fits-all answers for this, right? There will be companies where it absolutely makes zero sense for CS to own the renewals and upsells, like own the actual negotiation and penning the contract and all of that. So I would advise, you know, the CS leader to, one, make sure they know what makes sense for their company. Don't just architect something because you think that's the way that the industry is going. However, that being said, I do think because of the current economic situation, CS leaders at a minimum have to tie themselves to revenue somehow, have to be able to prove that the efforts that they are doing are driving gross renewal net retention. And if they don't directly have a goal or don't directly own that, it does get hard. So that is my two cents on that. Like, I personally think it's important that leaders get comfortable with owning revenue. I don't know what's going to happen in 2024. I wish I did. But my gut says we're going to have a little bit more tough times before it gets better. And when, you know, as somebody who has owned finance, right, in an organization, I know when I'm doing an audit on line by line expenses, I'm looking to cut things that are not mission critical, things that are not driving direct revenue, things that are not protecting future revenue. And you have to be very clear about how you tie those things together. So that's a good thing for folks to keep in mind, because it's a reality that's happening, not just within their internal organizations, but at their customer organizations as well.
Yeah. And just like the visual of, you know, that CFO going line by line, looking at those things. And I think those are the questions. Is it mission critical? Is it directly tied to creating more or protecting revenue? And yeah, those are the questions that get asked in these sorts of times. So thank you for explaining it in that way. So I did also want to chat a little bit about one-on-ones. And so wanted to ask you about, you know, just what are your thoughts about one-on-ones with your team when and how you tend to run them?
Yeah. One, you should be having them weekly. Okay. I take one-on-ones very seriously. I try to make sure, and look, stuff happens. Sometimes I have to move it out, you know, to a different time, but I try to make sure at least every week I'm spending 30 minutes to an hour with each of the folks on my team. Also, I am here to make my team members' lives easier. That is the scope of my responsibility. I'm here to remove barriers, help them think through difficult moments, help them navigate any tactical things that they may be struggling with, and also help them to come up with strategy. I, of course, will always have, you know, agenda items, but the majority of the agenda, and I made this very clear with all my team members, is owned by them. They own the agenda. This is their time with me for whatever they need. And, you know, so I always try, unless I have something super urgent or something very immediate that needs to be addressed, I give that time to them. Now, I will also say every one of my team members always knows where they stand with me. I am a in the moment feedback person. I never wait until they're one-on-one to give them feedback. So they never have to come into that one-on-one worrying about what is Miranda going to talk about today. We also use a tool where we add all of our agenda items. So that's always front and center as well. So they know what's in there. But the most important thing is the call out is the in the moment feedback. So if they did something amazing, they will hear from me immediately knowing that I really like that. Good job. That's high five moment. Or if there was an area of opportunity, I will immediately like say, hey, let's hop on and just chit chat about this observation. Right. I don't save that for one-on-ones because I want to make one-on-ones a safe place, not a scary place.
I love it. And so how did you get better at giving the in-the-moment feedback? Is this something that you got better at over the course of time? Is there a way that you remind yourself to do that? You know, some people don't find it as easy to do. So I'm wondering if there are any tips or tricks there.
It's important to do when you're managing folks. So you just have to get into the habit of it. One, I just tell folks to evoke empathy. And think about, you know, being a human and what powers humans and what powers satisfaction in your role is generally having an understanding of where you are and where you're going and what path are you on, right? And a big part of that is making sure that you're providing feedback. I don't know if I have any amazing revolutionary tips. It's just you have to do it. Definitely have used the sandwich technique when I'm giving constructive criticism, or I will just come out and I'll ask the team member. Generally, they already know if they did something in a less than ideal way. And I'll ask them, so how do you think that went? Right. And they'll self critique and bring up the areas of opportunity and worth the investment. Three, just self assess and be honest with yourself about where you are. I think one of the biggest things that holds leaders back from growth is not being open to the idea that you have areas of opportunity and areas of growth. We all do. I do. You do. Everybody does. But those who actually grow are the ones that acknowledge it, create a plan, and start getting better. And instead, I'll agree. And then we'll say, let's create a plan to make that better, right? So there are varying ways to get into that habit. But the biggest thing is just starting to do it. I will add one little more tidbit on this. Get to know your team members, right? Know them as humans. That makes those moments so much easier when you do have to give constructive feedback. I don't want to get feedback from people I don't know. I'm like, you don't know me. Like, you don't know what my intentions are. You don't know, you know, what I'm navigating maybe in my personal world, right? I'm not saying you get too deep. You get as deep as they want you to. And then that makes it a more safe place for you to be able to deliver feedback in those moments that you need to, and the not so pleasant feedback.
Yeah, it's very interesting. Like the trust building concept, like this is why this stuff makes sense, because if there is trust that you have the best intentions, you're actually communicating the feedback to help them be better at what they're doing, and it, you know, comes from a truly constructive place, yeah, people will accept it a lot more easily. But if you don't spend the time to build the trust and the relationship, then, and you wonder why people don't listen to you.
Exactly.
Why is it I keep telling people to do things, but they just don't listen?
Exactly. Spot on.
Yeah. So Miranda, this has been an awesome conversation. We've talked about a lot of different things, including how to onboard customer success teams, how to hire, how to build high performing teams. We've talked about one-on-ones and feedback and so much more. The final question we always like to end on is, for all the managers and leaders constantly looking to get better at their craft, are there any final tips, tricks, or parting words of wisdom that you would leave them with?
So one, get a mentor. It's always nice to have somebody, and it could be somebody in your network or somebody you work with that you look up to but don't report directly to. I always find those relationships are super helpful to bounce things off from and maybe get feedback. Two, if you have the budget, executive coaches are chef's kiss. Like, it's amazing to be able to have that. I know not everybody has the budget, but if you do, it's definitely out of just sitting in the comfort of where they are. Like, discomfort is really good sometimes.
That's great advice and a great place to end it. Miranda, thanks so much for doing this.
Thank you for having me. This was fun.
And that's it for today. Thank you so much for tuning into this episode of the Super Managers Podcast. You can find the show notes and transcript at www.fellow.app/supermanagers. If you like the content, be sure to rate, review, and subscribe so you can get notified when we post the next episode. And please tell your friends and fellow managers about it. It'd be awesome if you could help us spread the word about the show. See you next time.